So the Women for Refugee Women recently helped organize your visit to Yarlswood in the UK. Regarding Yarlswood, you once said, quote, it's no accident that this detention center is tucked away in a pretty corner of Bedfordshire, out of sight, out of mind, end quote. Could you tell our listeners about Yarlswood and your involvement with the Home Office protest against the detention center?
I had no involvement with the protests. I'm in America and they're in England, so I wasn't at the Home Office.
Mm-hmm.
I went to visit the place to write a much longer piece, in fact, of which that's just a quote, to see what it was about. I was just interested. I have friends who are lawyers who described some of the policies in Yarlswood to me, and I wanted to see it for myself. I don't think it's a, no matter what you think of migration or the rights of immigrants or refugees, I don't think it's a matter of debate mm-hmm. that Yarlswood does not treat them optimally, mm-hmm. and that was my concern.
The reason I wanted to ask you about that is because this weekend, when the verdict in the Michael Dunn trial was made public, I thought about that in preparation for this interview. And I also thought about your most recent novel, N.W., on which you said was in part inspired by Shakespeare's Measure for Measure.
Right.
If I could quote you again, one of the things that you said about your novel really resonated me after the verdict in the trial was made public. And you said, the happy ending is never universal. Someone is always left behind. And in the London I grew up in, as it is today, that someone is more often than not a young black man, end quote. And so, of course, I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about Trayvon Martin and
right.
Jordan Davis. And I'm just wondering if you'd be willing to share with us some of your, you know, general thoughts about the outcome of the Dunn trial, the Zimmerman trial, and other cases where the words you spoke about N.W. seem to really ring true, even here in the United States.
I don't know the ins and outs, the meticulous ins and outs of those cases. I'm, from what I understand, like most people, I have a sense of the tragedy of both those cases. What interests me more generally about the way young black men are perceived on the street is this assumption of fear
mm-hmm.
on the part of people who look at them, approach them, pass them in the street. And in fact, far more than those people, I'm not really concerned with the views that people have, apart from in something like the Trayvon case where it becomes tragic. What concerns me more is what happens inside a young black child who grows up, as all children grow up, with a sense of themselves as central and in some sense innocent
mm-hmm.
and open to the world, and the ways in which that feeling gets closed down is my concern.
Mm-hmm.
I think when I was writing N.W., that was what I was trying to get at, that something happens, at least in my country, to young men of color who go from being open children, age 8 or 9, to realizing, A, in some sense they are powerless, and that, B, the only power they have, on the street at least, is to inspire fear.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reaction that they are given in the world. And I think you can see it very directly in a single family. In my case, as the only black girl in a family of mm-hmm. two other black boys, it's very clear how that experience differs. There are all kinds of reactions black women can get in the world,
mm-hmm.
from the attraction of strangers or interest or curiosity. But fear is not usually one of those emotions,
mm-hmm.
just because we're women, basically.
Mm-hmm,
it's
mm-hmm.
very easy when you're growing up with black brothers to see how your experience separates and how it separates in a tragic way.
And now I'm thinking, too, about some of the other contributions that you've given to conversations we all have about race and socioeconomic status and cultural capital. But in this case, I'm thinking about the way you've talked about how those things relate to a so-called authenticity, right? So if we're staying on the subject of black men, you've discussed this particularly regarding rapper Jay-Z and President Barack
right.
Obama. I'm wondering, though, if you can talk about the ways in which you, as a black woman, have experienced and addressed contention regarding a so-called authenticity and your own personal life and or your professional work as it relates to race. So this relationship between black and authentic.
I guess I've decided to ignore it for the most part.
Good call.
That's basically, I kind of early on decided in my life that I had to pursue the things that interested me, and I couldn't concern myself with whether they seemed like black concerns to other people.
Right.
Or white concerns to other people.
Right.
One of the things about being mixed race is that you're always going to disappoint somebody. Particularly if they live within these quite binary categories. What interests me about the idea of blackness as an essential quality or whiteness as an essential quality, you can take it as a kind of thing of pride.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're doing, by definition, is exactly what people you would accuse of racism or prejudice are doing, which is taking a series of characteristics and making of them an essential trait. It doesn't matter that you're doing it in a positive sense. Mm-hmm. I understand the desire to do it in a positive sense because people who feel abandoned or neglected or fearful are likely to join together in a solid group, you know, and express themselves as a group.
Mm-hmm.
But I suppose, if you ask me personally, I believe that people are radically individual,
mm-hmm.
no matter what race they're from, and they can always elect to be part of a collectivity, and they can always express what I would put it more as a love.
Mm-hmm.
My interest in black culture is a choice that I make.
Mm-hmm.
I can choose to be interested. I like hip-hop. I like black writers. I like African culture. Those are choices that I make. But they're also, I believe, choices open to many people. To me, culture is nothing but except an expression of love. It doesn't run through your blood.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that you're born with. It's not essential to your being. It's a choice that people make every day. And you can make it because your parents made it. That's one definition of it. You can say, I am a Jew because my parents were Jews. Or I am an African-American with these tastes and beliefs because my parents had them. Mm-hmm. You can always do that, and there's nothing wrong with it. But to me, that is always an expression of a choice, no matter how much of a necessary condition of your life it might seem.
I'm wondering if you could give a little preview of some of the things that you'll be discussing during your talk when you get here.
Well, I'm giving a lecture called Why Write? And I guess, you know, I wrote it in response to my students, really. You know, over the past few years, I've noticed that there's two kind of extremes of emotion that students turn up to creative writing classes with. They either have a kind of overblown sense of what a writer is, like they're going to come and save the world and soon they'll be getting a medal of President Obama and... You know, they're going to be on the cover of Time and all that. So that's half the class. And the other half is completely depressed and feel like it's all absurd and publishing is dead and there's no purpose and why are they bothering? And, you know, it's this kind of seesaw of extreme hubris and then total devastation. So I thought, is there a way that I could write something that realistically and calmly lay out the benefits of writing and the purpose of writing, even in an industry which is... you know, shrinking so radically and seems so difficult. Is there a way to talk about it as a vocation, as something worth doing, even when it feels like it's not worth doing? So that's what it's about, basically.
Well, we are immensely looking forward to your visit. We're just about out of time here, but I do want to thank you so much for your time, and I encourage all of our listeners to come visit you when you're here next Tuesday for the McLean Symposium.
I'm really looking forward to it. Thank you.
I'm glad we are too. Thank you so much, Professor Smith.
Thank you very much.